Greetings, everyone. Once again, Laszlo Montgomery here, bringing you the next installment of our chronological overview of all the dynasties in China, going back 4,000 years to 2194 BC. We're now in the second half of the Tang Dynasty, which ran from 618 to 907, 289 years in all. We left off last time with the Tang Dynasty in shambles by the second half of the 8th century. The Anlu Shan, or Anshi, rebellion was the turning point for the fortunes of the Li family and their Tang Dynasty. It raged during the reign of three emperors, Su Zong, Dai Zong, and De Zong. It's all over in 763, but the whole period of chaos and death and destruction caused the center in Chang'an to weaken as the power and independence of all these military strongmen or warlords increased. Nobody won this conflict. Both sides just sort of mutually agreed to give up and go home in the end. That's how nasty this upheaval was. The Tang treasury was depleted, as were the state warehouses. The emperors had to subcontract out most of the heavy fighting to mercenaries and non-Han Chinese armies, and this was very costly. The sharp reduction in the population caused by the direct and indirect effects of the rebellion and the chaos that came with it decimated the tax rolls, so no income was coming into the state. It was like the Eastern Zhou times or other periods when the emperor reigned only as a figurehead and was utilized for political gain by whoever was powerful enough to control him. Now was one of those times. The Dai Zong emperor and his son, the Emperor De Zong, who reigned a respectable 26 years, tried to put the Tang back together. Their attempts at curbing the powers of these regional warlords failed, of course. I mean, these warlords weren't like Cincinnatus or Washington. Once they had this power and authority, I mean, they played for keeps. As the 8th century ended and the 9th began, these were the last serious attempts to make a comeback for the Tang. It's hard to believe, but during this time, the Tang government was constantly being harassed by none other than the Tibetans. The Tibetans had quite the empire that ran from 618 to 842, so they've been quite a menace to the Tang dynasty. The Uyghurs as well were also a complicated neighbor in the north and the west. The Tang had formed a strategic alliance with the Uyghurs years earlier as a weapon to help defeat Anlushan and his rebels. It was a deal made with the devil, and though the Uyghurs were instrumental in defeating the rebel forces, they became a real headache for the emperor and were able to cause the emperor pain at will. The previous two emperors, Dai Zong and Su Zong, had opened the Pandora's box of the eunuchs. The power of the eunuchs permeated every aspect of power. They were initially prohibited from holding any positions of power, but this began to change during the reign of Xuanzong. It wasn't long before they were fully involved in the day-to-day decision-making and in deciding on regional appointments. During Dai Zong's time, there were even eunuchs involved in military matters and in the affairs of the palace guard. So this legendary power of these palace eunuchs in ancient China all gets traced to the second half of the Tang Dynasty. We'll see under the reign of Emperor Xuanzong of Tang, beginning in 805. There's a brief rally, but the Xuanzong emperor, like so many progressive-minded reformers, met a tragic end, and he was unable to revive the Tang. And to attest to the unchecked power of the palace eunuchs by now, not only was Xuanzong killed by the treachery of the eunuchs, so was his son, the Xianzong emperor. It really is a recipe for disaster for the Tang, but they keep on chugging along with one, you know, good emperor after another. No one is a Taizong or Xianzong, but the emperors, though controlled and manipulated by a great extent by these eunuchs, they were okay rulers. So when Chinese around the world remember the Tang Dynasty and that age when China was the king of the world in some respects, it was the first half of the Tang, not the second half, which is where we're going to pick up today. Though direct and indirect control of the lands to the north and the west had been lost to a great extent, Chang'an was still the place. I mean, you still continued to see a steady number of tribute-bearing missions, and though the nation and the government had seen better days, the constancy and sort of the greatness of Chinese culture and all it yielded still acted as a magnet for all the curious and adventurous. The empire might be in decline, but you'd never suspect that from the volume of maritime trade that continued. In these days, the Silk Road was an iffy proposition due to the geopolitical circumstances of the time, so sea trade really started to take off about now. The government administrative machine, in spite of all the problems and decay that had set in, was still running quite smoothly, which preserved a kind of normalcy long after the Tang had peaked in the 740s, 750s. The Kingdom of Nanzhao, which was down in the region of what we today call the Golden Triangle, mostly it was located in present-day Yunnan province. It sort of came into being in 737 after all the various Zhao, or small kingdoms down there, united into this entity known as Nanzhao. They were the people who established the second capital of Nanzhao in what is present-day Kunming. This was in 763. The first capital was in Dali. Sensing a weakness in the Tang far away in Chang'an, the Nanzhao started creeping northward into Sichuan, into lands that were technically part of Tang China. They also were spreading west into Burma and east into Laos and Vietnam. Of course, the major power in this region was the Tibetan Empire, and the Nanzhao were careful to kowtow to them rather than to the Chinese. They remained fiercely independent, and the only ones who could defeat them were the Mongols, but that's still centuries in the future. But the Nanzhao incursions into Sichuan were somewhat of a humiliation and a sign of the times for the Tang. As I said, the Tibetans were the big power now. The Nanzhao had been more of a nuisance, causing trouble on the fringes of the empire, but the Tibetans were a lot more proactive about smashing and grabbing. They moved into Xinjiang, Gansu, Ningxia, and as far east as Shanxi. They did this during the Anlushan Rebellion, when the Tang armies had been moved closer to the action in the east. In 763, the Tibetan armies ransacked Chang'an, forcing the Taizong Emperor to flee. Among the consequences of the Anlushan Rebellion were that Chinese power and influence in Xinjiang was shut out for about 1,000 years. And if you look on a map, the territory formerly known as Chinese Turkestan and today as Xinjiang takes up the upper quadrant of western China, with Tibet taking up the bottom half. So losing Xinjiang from the empire meant a very large loss of territory. However, most tragic was this loss of power and influence in Xinjiang also meant the end of Chinese involvement in Central Asian affairs and the possible sinification of those peoples and all those regions adjacent to China. Under the Wuzong Emperor, 840 to 846, he had a bit of a Confucian revival that tipped the scales in favor of the Confucianists rather than the Buddhists, who had enjoyed so much favor throughout the Tang Dynasty. Between 841 and 845, there was a very enthusiastic government campaign to rid the government of the overabundance of Buddhist monks and nuns involved in various day-to-day affairs and rituals. The objective was to expand the tax rolls and force all these exempt Buddhist clergy or semi-clergy to get out of their tax-free situation where they more or less lived off the bounty of the emperor. By forcing these people into laity rather than remaining a part of the clergy, all of a sudden the tax rolls expanded by hundreds of thousands. You had a larger pool to draw from for whatever state projects needed state labor. The government also helped themselves to temples and all that the temples contained. This brought in massive amounts of gold. And the Confucianists were happy to be standing by to pour oil into the fire, pointing out to the emperor how the Buddhists had undermined traditional Chinese values, especially that of ancestor worship and disregarding the sacred chain of loyalty from son to father to ruler. And when it came to pointing fingers at the laziness and non-productiveness of the Buddhist clergy, the Buddhists were like their own enemies and, gave the Confucian faction and government plenty of ammo to put an end to their comfy privileges. Actually, it was sort of a xenophobic persecution, too, because not only were they trying to cleanse the government of Buddhists, many of them not Chinese, but of Zoroastrians and Christians as well. And if you recall from an earlier episode, the Nestorians were the first Christians to travel to China. In fact, anything that wasn't either the too homegrown Chinese religions of Confucianism and Taoism. It was not welcome in Tang Dynasty China during the 840s, and it was a far cry from the days of tolerance seen under the two greatest emperors, Taizong and Xuanzong. In any case, this period where the Buddhists fell out of favor pretty much came to an end with the death of their nemesis, the Wuzong Emperor. He was a rather hardcore Taoist and very mixed up with all these dubious elixirs of life concocted by all these Taoist practitioners of the arts of alchemy. The Wuzong Emperor, like Qin Shi Huang back in the 3rd century BC, probably died chasing the same old potion of immortality. 875 to 884 really spelled the real end for the Tang Dynasty. Alas, another rebellion that got big really fast and couldn't be put down. This one involved a failed official, Huang Chao, and this rebellion is none other than the Huang Chao Rebellion, or in Mandarin, the Huang Chao Zhiluan, or Huang Chao Qi Yi. We're now in the reign of the Yizong Emperor. He came to power, as was commonplace during this later Tang period, under what we can call interesting circumstances. Yizong was two emperors after Wuzong, he of the Buddhist persecution fame. From these heights of glory, it went from Xuanzong, Suzong, Taizong, Dezong, Shunzong for a year, then Xianzong, Jingzong, Wenzong, Wuzong, and to confuse things a little, in 846, 859, we came to the third to the last Tang emperor, and this really was the last good one. This was the Xuanzong Emperor. Different from Xuanzong of Yang Guifei repute, this is a different character. X-U-A-N is the pinyin, different tone from Xuan. So these two Tang emperors, 100 years apart, history books give them the same spelling, but it's two different Chinese characters. Xuanzong and Xuanzong. And if you're wondering, what's with these Zong? Has anyone noticed almost every emperor's name is something or other? Zong, Z-O-N-G. I just named the emperors from Xuanzong to Xuanzong, and they all end with the character Zong, first town. It means ancestor, and these names are known as temple names. They're given posthumously, and this name is the one that's carved into the ancestral tablets and placed in the Zumiao, or the ancestral temple. So while he was alive, no one called him this, all these emperor names are posthumous names. The names, nonetheless, that historians most often used and the names they are remembered by. Now, let's come back to the story. Sorry for wandering off on that linguistic tangent. The Yizong Emperor is on the throne. The Tang has less than a quarter century left before it's swept away, and then the Mandate of Heaven is fumbled back and forth for a while. By the time of Yizong, the Mandate of Heaven was not with the Tang emperors. It was a well-known fact that this Yizong emperor loved his extravagant lifestyle in Chang'an and all the perks of being an emperor. While Yizong is conspicuously living large in the palace, the Huang Chao Rebellion was raging amidst a great famine that was followed by floods and bad weather. Taxes had swung back to oppressive once again. Huang Chao caused havoc all over central China and clashed with Tang forces constantly. His epic long march between 878 to 880 took Huang Chao and his army from Shandong and Henan down through Anhui, Jiangsu, Zhejiang, Fujian, and to southern Guangdong, where the rebel forces sacked Guangzhou and wiped out the foreign traders there. Then Huang Chao's forces went north through Guangxi and Guizhou, and then crossed the Yangtze and set their sights on Luoyang and Chang'an. Huang Chao meandered through Hubei and continued north to Henan, where Luoyang was taken easily. And then when it looked like curtains for the Xizong Emperor, who was on the throne now, his eunuchs, who controlled every aspect of his life, packed him up and hightailed it south to Chengdu. In 881, Huang Chao and his forces took Chang'an, and the bloodbath that ensued was biblical in its proportions. Huang Chao had delusions of grandeur and promptly declares himself emperor and moved into the Tang Emperor's palace and declares the founding of the state of Qi. Huang Chao schemes his way to grab hold of that mandate of heaven, but it just remained elusive. Rebel troops did all the horrible things rebel troops do when they sack a rich cosmopolitan city. Eunuchs were slaughtered, palaces were destroyed. Chang'an was completely sacked and razed, and not for the first time in history. in July 884, this rebellion ran out of steam, and Huang Chao and his entire family were ultimately executed by one of his nephews, who was trying to surrender to government forces and bring this never-ending period of violence to an end. And so, with the quelling of the Huang Chao Rebellion, the second of the three great rebellions in Chinese history comes to an end, the other two being the Yellow Turban Rebellion, which we covered in the Eastern Han. This rebellion, of course, laid the groundwork for the Three Kingdoms period. Now we have the Huang Chao Rebellion, which essentially is the historical event that kills the Tang Dynasty, and the last of the three great rebellions we haven't come to yet, but we will when we get to the time of the Xianfeng Emperor during the last dynasty of China, the Qing, when we look at the Taiping Rebellion. With the death of Huang Chao in 884, the Tang was already down for the count. The Xizong Emperor was able to return to Chang'an in the lucky year of 888, but not lucky for the emperor, for he died in that year and was succeeded by a brother who reigned as the Zhaozong Emperor. At this point, it's already over for the Tang, and although it doesn't officially fall until 907, at this point, at the dawn of the 10th century AD, China is again transitioning to another one of its classic periods of disunity. All the major players who would play a role in the final fall of the Tang and the five dynasties and 10 kingdoms that followed are all getting themselves set up and ready to declare themselves royalty. Well, henceforth, until the Northern Song is declared in 960, it's not a very good time in China. The final half century of the Tang is one of utter and complete misery, sort of like the old 16 kingdoms period of 304 to 311. It was a period of pretty much complete anarchy, and in China, as elsewhere, in good times and bad, it was always the peasants who suffered worst, and late 9th century, early 10th century China was a more abysmal time than usual for the poor. So let's keep going here and finish off the Tang and look at the five dynasties in the north and the 10 kingdoms of the central and south of China. As I mentioned, the line of demarcation between the Tang Dynasty and the later Liang Dynasty was the year 907. To set this up, we need to look at the one who drove the sword into the Tang. This was a man surnamed Zhu, who went by several names, Zhu Quanzhong, Zhu Wen, Zhu Huang, and Zhu San. He was a tough guy who served under Huang Chao during the rebellion. As I mentioned, the rebellion was put down in 884, thanks in part to Zhu Wen, who, when he saw Huang Chao was surrounded and wasn't going to last, he dramatically changed sides and helped the Tang army defeat the last remnants of this rebel bandit army. He was given additional powers and men as part of his reward for changing sides. But, you know, before long, he too became yet another powerful warlord, contending for power. And he seized Chang'an in the year 901. 4 years later, he kills the emperor and most of the Tang imperial family. He puts a teenage Tang puppet on the throne until 907, when he pushes the puppet emperor aside, and then Zhu Wen establishes his own dynasty, the later Liang, or Ho Liang, in 907. He is crowned the first emperor Taizu, the dubious distinction of being the last puppet emperor of the Tang belongs to Emperor Ai. Zhu Wen killed his father, the Zhaozong Emperor, in 904, and then this 13-year-old now becomes the Aizong Emperor and Zhu Wen's puppet until, as I said, in 907, Zhu Wen forces his kid to abdicate, and he lets him off easy, but then has second thoughts and ends up having the last Tang emperor poisoned the following year near his 17th birthday. Emperor Aizong, that means the pitiful emperor. That's his temple name. The later Liang, they became the first of the five dynasties. It went later Liang, later Tang, later Jin, later Han, and later Zhou. We use the word later, or Mandarin Ho, of course, because there were already dynasties that had used these names. Now, it's quite messy starting here in 907. The Tang is gone and had been for the past 100 years, or more or less existed in name. In the north, you have the first of what will be these five short-lived dynasties. The first, the later Liang, lasted from 907 to 923, just merely 16 years. To get a picture of the size of the later Liang, you're not talking anything more than parts of Henan and Hubei provinces. It's not like they controlled China north of the Yangtze from Gansu to the coast. You're not going to see any amazing things come out of this period. Now, what's going on elsewhere in China? There's there's no more Zhongguo or Middle Kingdom anymore, as far as a state is concerned. Now, the place may be all broken up into big and little pieces, but culturally, they all identify with what has become the Han Chinese culture, and certainly north of the Yangtze, everyone spoke what we know today as Mandarin. The southerners, of course, and even today, all had their own little regional dialects, and the country may not have been there, but the cultural identity is alive and well and remains constant now, throughout the upheaval and the period of disunity. In the north, you had these dynasties that followed each other consecutively. Down in the south, you had these 10 kingdoms that were all, sort of coexisting and not necessarily at the same time. And that's why they call the north dynasties, and the south are called kingdoms. So the first of the five dynasties of the north, the later Liang, was toppled in 920 by one Li Keyong, who ushered the next of the five dynasties in, this one called the later Tang. Li Keyong was, all along, he was Zhu Wen's bitter rival. So Zhu Wen, who I mentioned, he's the one that put the sword in the Tang dynasty and set up the later Liang. Li Keyong, he's not really a real Li. He was a Turk of the Shatuo tribe, and three of the five dynasties were actually led by the Shatuo Turks. So helpful had Li Keyong's father been to the Tang Yizong emperor that, to show his gratitude, the emperor gave the imperial surname of Li to the father. So Li Keyong, his real surname was Zhuye, but after his father became a Li, so did he, and so he names his little dynasty the later Tang, being a Li and all. Of the five dynasties, only the later Liang had a reputation for brutality and violence greater than the norm. It was a very repressive time, short though it was. Zhu Wen, he was murdered by his son in 912, and his son was murdered in the following year by one of his younger brothers, and this younger brother, Zhu Zhen, met a bad end in 923. He was forced to commit suicide or killed by his guard, depending on the version you read, when the forces of Li Keyong's later Tang stormed the later Liang capital of Kaifeng. Now, Li Keyong, he'd been dead since 908, so the later Tang dynasty was actually established by his son, Li Chunxu. The later Tang was a dynasty of greater territorial expanse than its predecessor. The Li Keyong, Li Chunxu power base was up in Shanxi, so he brought all that loyal territory to the table when he toppled the later Liang. Trading on his adoptive Li surname, these Turkic Lis claimed they were restoring the Tang dynasty. This dynasty also didn't yield much in the way of greatness. They moved the capital from Kaifeng to good old reliable Luoyang. It lasted 14 years before it was toppled by another Turkic power who called their particular dynasty the later Jin. That was followed 10 years later by the later Han in 950, and the fifth of the five dynasties was the later Zhou, the northern Song, of course, commencing in 960. 936 was the end of the later Tang. It started to get complicated here, because now I have to introduce this big elephant in the room, who I haven't mentioned up till now. You have, all this time, up in the north, northwest, a race of people known as the Khitan, or in Mandarin, the Chitan. During this Five Dynasties period, you have this very big Khitan dynasty up in Manchuria. Manchuria, for those not familiar with it, are the three northeast provinces of China, Heilongjiang, Jilin, and Liaoning. North Korea borders Manchuria. This Khitan Empire, or Chitanguo, covered part of Mongolia as well as all of Manchuria. It was called, on and off, the Liao Dynasty. The Liao Dynasty ran from 907, which was the end of the Tang, until 1125, when the Liao were toppled by the army of the Southern Song, who we haven't gotten to yet. We'll look at that more later when we cover the Song. I'm also sure at a later date in the future I'll focus on the Liao Dynasty and maybe come back and take a closer look at all these Central Asian people. We've sort of been lumping them into either Turkic or Mongol people, but it's way, way more complicated than that and worth taking a closer look. But not today. The later Tang was toppled by the later Jin, as I mentioned. the Liao was dragged into this affair by Shi Jingtang, son-in-law to the emperor. He made a pact with the devil and basically made a deal with the Liao emperor to enlist their help in overthrowing the later Tang and setting himself up as emperor. In exchange for this, Shi Jingtang, or Emperor Gaozu of later Jin, as he was now called, gave up the so-called 16 prefectures, the Yanyun Shiliuzhou that ran from present-day Beijing up to the city of Datong in northern Shanxi. This strategic territory, now controlled by the Liao, more or less gave them carte blanche to play a dominating role in northern China. The later Jin were viewed as a puppet kingdom controlled by the Khitan Liao rulers. When the later Jin rose up and tried to get back the 16 prefectures, the Liao moved in and put an end to them in 947. Like the later Liang and later Tang, you can include the later Jin as another dynasty that didn't yield any interesting achievements or anything to write home about. So, three down, two to go. 947, now you have the later Han, which lasted only 4 years. You had the untimely death of the founder, followed by a weak son and an ambitious military commissioner. A deadly combination. The later Han went down, and now you had the fifth and final dynasty up in the north, the later Zhou. The founder, Guo Wei, tried to do some good and maybe would have been able to do some great things, but he had an early and untimely death 3 years into his reign in 954. In the remaining 6 years of this dynasty, you had two emperors not worth mentioning, and in 960, Zhao Kuangyin, he commanded cavalry units for the later Zhou rulers. He rose up the ranks and within the later Zhou pyramid, and after an unstable period with a boy emperor on the throne, he made his move and set himself up as emperor of what became the Northern Song, and this will be the topic for our next podcast. Down in the south, where the Ten Kingdoms were, it's a little bit more complicated. The Ten Kingdoms, as I said, they existed concurrently, not consecutively, like the dynasties in the north. These kingdoms were the Wu, Min, Southern Han, Chu, Northern Han, Jingnan, former Shu, later Shu, Southern Tang, and the Wu Yue. Let's look at the longest lasting and most noteworthy one, the Wu Yue Kingdom. What's significant about the Wu Yue is that the people of this region, which included Shanghai and Ningbo, sort of developed their own distinct culture and language. From this kingdom, we have the Wu dialect, also known as Shanghainese. My company, which is based up in Ningbo, just south of Shanghai, also speaks a flavor of this Wu dialect. They developed their own cooking style and tastes and a whole kind of Wu culture. I suppose we could go from kingdom to kingdom, but honestly, folks, there's not a lot of meat on these bones. These are all kingdoms that simply took advantage of the lack of any central power, and they just did their own things and existed throughout Sichuan, Guangdong, Hunan, Hubei, Fujian, and Jiangxi. When we get deeper into the Song Dynasty, we'll look at these various statelets as they fall one after the other. The Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms period is a well-documented period, but I regret to say, unlike other periods of disunity like the Spring and Autumn period, Warring States period, this period didn't yield too much richness. This period of disunity from the end of the Tang to the start of the Song from 907 to 960 was another violent and crazy time in Chinese history. Then after this, we have the Northern Song, Southern Song, and then the Mongol Yuan Dynasty of Kublai Khan, who we looked at back in the early days of the China History Podcast. After that, it's just the Ming and the Qing, and we are finished with our dynasty overview. And once we finish with the Qing in 1911, we're going to stop there and we'll continue on, as I mentioned in the early days, to jump in and out at different periods in history and focus in on all the details that we jumped over during the course of this overview. So I guess we're going to stop here now. I hope you enjoyed the Tang Dynasty overview. It's truly one of the great periods in world history and a fun time to study. We'll keep coming back to the Tang in episodes to come. For now, it's pretty much the end of the good old days for the old Chinese Northern or Northwest aristocracy. These powerful families played all the major roles in creating all the history up till now. Their day is gone, and it will become a new age in China with the Song Dynasty, which is ruled by new men rather than the old aristocrats. Another age from 960 to 1279, 319 years in all, we'll see more greatness and glory like the Tang. In fact, the Tang and the Song, these two dynasties, are considered China's finest hour. So, please keep listening. In 960, the age we are just about to enter, the world is really an interesting place. The Saxon kings were still ruling in England. Harald Bluetooth united Denmark and Norway. This period at the end of the Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms were also the final years of the Carolingian Frankish Kingdom. Hugh Capet was waiting in the wings. This was also the time of the Carolingians in Germany, and the Magyar invasions had just ended. The Moorish period of Spain was in full bloom. The Imperium Romanum Sacrum, or Holy Roman Empire, was created. We're midway into the Heian period in Japan, and still a good 200 years or so away from Minamoto no Yoritomo and the first shogunate at Kamakura. So let's stop here and call it a day. We'll see you next time when we dish up some more Chinese history for the masses. This is Laszlo Montgomery once again wishing everyone a fond and pleasant farewell from the very edge of L.A. County here in Southern California. Please feel free to visit us at the ChinaHistoryPodcast.com, on the World Wide Web, and of course in the iTunes Store, if you're so inclined. We'll see you next week, I hope, for another exciting episode of the China History Podcast. Take care, everyone.